I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and many Americans are returning from a holiday break with questions about Yemen. The impoverished country just below Saudi Arabia has been in the spotlight since that failed Christmas Day bomb plot, the suspect believed to have received explosive materials in Yemen. General David Petraeus made a surprise visit there over the weekend, and British and U.S. embassies there are closed for security reasons. It's widely believed that two Saudis released from Guantanamo Bay during the Bush administration traveled to Yemen to foment al-Qaeda activity there. And today, the AP is reporting that six Guantanamo Bay detainees released to Yemen just days before Christmas have been released by the Yemeni government, two of them just this past weekend. Well, with us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, BBC correspondent Jonathan Head. Jonathan, let's start there. The Yemeni government working with the U.S. to fight al-Qaeda. Well, what have you heard about these reports that former Guantanamo Bay detainees were released by the Yemeni government as recently as this past weekend?
Nothing confirmed yet, Robin, but we have heard some reports here that they have been released. They've been held for questioning, and the Yemeni authorities have made it known that they had not found any evidence yet of any involvement in al-Qaeda.
And there are conflicting reports. The Wall Street Journal headline reads that the six detainees have been held by Yemen. But also the story reports that a promise was made to General Petraeus this past weekend that former Guantanamo inmates in Yemen would not be released.
The problem is we don't know exactly what was in those talks. General Petraeus' visit here was kept very quiet indeed. All we know is that he was carrying a letter from President Obama outlining areas in which the U.S. would like better cooperation with the Yemeni authorities, and that he had a long discussion with President Ali Abdullah Saleh here, but we don't know much more than that.
And what are people in Yemen telling you about the way the government is pursuing al-Qaeda?
It's a very confusing time in Yemen. There's an awful lot of issues they're grappling with. Frankly, al-Qaeda is not very high on their agenda, and the sudden wave of international interest, I think, has caught this country completely by surprise. Here in Sana'a, this is not the same as many of the tribal areas where al-Qaeda operates. This is an old, traditional Arabic city where a large part of people's living came from tourism, and that tourism has completely collapsed in recent years because of security threats. And so on the one hand, they've suddenly lost that foreign income and all those foreign visitors. Suddenly they're getting a welter of dignitaries coming in saying, now we've got to have a cooperation in the fight against terrorism. It's very confusing for them.
Well, the Yemeni government forces have had clashes with al-Qaeda militants as recently as today, where we see reports that two were killed, although a suspected al-Qaeda leader escaped. But tell us more about why the U.S. and British embassies were closed. We understand that there are reports that security forces lost track of six trucks that were loaded with weapons and explosives.
Well, there was an operation last month in which they say more than 30 militants were killed, that they interrupted in an advanced stage a plan to bomb the British embassy and other Western targets, but that in that attack a number of the organisers got away with some of their material. They were car bombs they were planning. That's one of the reasons the embassies have been shut, but there are other bits of intelligence, the statements made by al-Qaeda threatening embassy staff directly. It makes it a very, very tense time, and these embassies have been closed many times before. Remember, the U.S. embassy was attacked with a full-scale assault 15 months ago. 19 people were killed then. Now, the government's claims to be taking on al-Qaeda, but at the same time, it's going to fit its fight against al-Qaeda in the context of all the other things that threaten it. And, you know, sometimes it's not going to be clear whether it's going to be making al-Qaeda the highest priority.
So, Jonathan, as you look ahead, as you scan the horizon, what are the chances of success and how would you even define it in Yemen?
I think the options for the U.S. administration are very limited in Yemen. They have to work through a government that is deeply disliked in much of the country, is corrupt and led by a leader who's been very skillful in managing all the different tribes here in the past, but is getting old, and where the authority of the government has weakened a lot in recent years. So any U.S. backing for this government is going to arouse opposition. The use of U.S. missiles or drones risks provoking popular anger. And in fact, the cells here, the al-Qaeda cells, are mobile and small. They present very few targets. You've got to remember that they're dealing with a country where poverty is the highest in the Arab world. The population is the fastest growing. There needs to be a lot of work on development here if you're going to dry up the source of recruits for al-Qaeda. That's a very rich one in Yemen.
And the U.S. can't do this alone. I mean, this is Saudi Arabia's neighbor, for instance. I mean, is there thinking that there's got to be more of a regional effort?
Well, I guess that was the thinking behind the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown's call for an international summit, you know, to look at all the aspects. The problems are absolutely critical here, and I think many observers are saying that perhaps we're a bit too late in Yemen. This country started a serious slide into chronic disorder more than 5 years ago. They're running out of oil, which is their only source of income. Here in the capital, Sana'a, they're running out of water. This city won't even be viable in about 20 or 30 years' time. Those are immense challenges, and they are going to require a sustained and comprehensive international effort if there's any hope of reversing them.
BBC correspondent Jonathan Head in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. Jonathan, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, today we want to have a conversation about prostitution, specifically about attempts to curb prostitution and all its side effects by educating the Johns, the men who pay money for sex. So it follows, this may not be a conversation for everyone, but it's one that's getting started in small rooms across the country where Johns are directly confronted with the long-term consequences of their need for immediate gratification and often confronted by former prostitutes themselves. John schools have been started in Baltimore, Nashville, San Francisco, Worcester, Massachusetts. Michael Shively is a senior associate at the Center on Crime, Drugs, and Justice at Apt Associates here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's studied these programs and measured whether they're able to effectively reduce demand for prostitution. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having this conversation and for having me.
We're going to speak to some women who are involved in the Worcester, Massachusetts John Schools. But first, explain, what is a John School program? How does it work?
The simplest description of it is that it's just an education program. And the John School model that most people think about when they think about John Schools was the first one in San Francisco. And that was a diversion program. By diversion, I mean that if they agree to attend the class and they complete it successfully, then they get their charges dismissed. So they're diverted away from criminal justice sanctions.
Right.
But the education component is really independent of that, because some of these education programs for Johns are not a diversion program. They're a condition of sentencing. So they still get the punishment, and they have to attend a class.
And typically, what goes on in these classes?
The key elements that you find in most John schools, and there are about 30 or 35 active John schools in the United States, the key elements are education about legal risks that the men face if they continue to purchase sex, health risks that they face for doing the same, and also the health consequences for their other sex partners and even children and unborn children. A third key element is testimony from survivors of commercial sexual exploitation or former prostitutes who talk about what they experienced, what they really believe, what their lives are like while they're involved in commercial sex. That tends to be the most powerful testimony, if you can judge by the reaction of the men.
Well, does it work? You conducted a Justice Department-funded evaluation of the John School program in San Francisco. It's been there for 14 years. Did it work in reducing demand?
In San Francisco, this program started in 1995. And when you look 10 years pre-program and then the 10 years that followed, the rearrest rates for men fell by about half.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yes. You know, there are a lot of different explanations for that. One would be that it had just been displaced. It went from San Francisco somewhere else. But fortunately, we had statewide data, and we could follow the men from San Francisco anywhere in the state to see if that's where they ended up popping up, and we did not find that it had been displaced. The conclusion that we reached after looking at the plausibility of all the different explanations is that the commercial sex market had been impacted and reduced.
Well, let's take a look at what might be criticisms of the John School programs. For instance, I can hear someone saying, oh my God, my taxpayer dollars are going to paying some guys to sit in a classroom to have a prostitute talk to them again.
First of all, no taxpayer dollars go into that.
Yeah.
What happens is the men pay a fee, and this is pretty common. So no taxpayer dollars go into the John School program.
Well, but there is one other criticism. Skeptics of John Schools, including Melissa Farley of the California Prostitution Research and Education Center, say that the programs let men off the hook. Yes, they might not recidivate. They might not go back out on the streets. That's good. But they avoid conviction for a crime they committed.
My response would be, let off the hook compared to what? Because the initial penalties are so minimal in most places. It's a citation, so it isn't much of a drop going from almost no punishment to no punishment.
Well, she says make the punishment stronger.
I don't at all disagree with her on that point. I don't believe that it's necessary, and I'm not even certain it's beneficial, to dismiss the charges for the men simply because they've taken a John School class. Now, a model that I personally believe looks stronger is in Norfolk, Virginia. Now, in Norfolk, Virginia, I would call it the toughest John School program in the country. The men pay a fine, not a fee, but a fine of $1,500, and it's not optional. They have to attend the program, and that is not optional. After attending the program, they don't get their charges dismissed. And they also have to do community service. And while they're on community service, they have to pay a supervision fee of $40 a day. And they also can have their car seized and have to pay an impound fee to get it back. Now, the education component is embedded in the middle of a relatively extremely tough set of sanctions.
Is there a core group of Johns that city officials realize are going to need more than the John School?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the biggest mistakes people make in conversations about prostitution and about how to approach Johns is considering them as a homogeneous population, as all looking for one thing. Clearly, sex is the one thing that is a common denominator, but there are many other things going on, and I think most of the research suggests that there are at least four major categories of Johns, one of which, and I think it's the one you're alluding to, one of which would be a sociopath or a psychopathic personality, where the whole point is to hurt or humiliate or degrade women. And those men are very tough to deal with, and certainly a one-day talking exercise in a John School is going to have no impact on a person like that.
What are the other categories?
One is the lonely, sad sack guy who is looking for sex, would prefer to be in a relationship and have a girlfriend, but isn't getting it done and resort to buying sex. A second would be kind of their opposite, men that want sex and none of the other stuff that goes along with it. They don't want a relationship. And a third would be the thrill seeker. They are not happy with the same person over time. They look for different races, ethnicities, and they like the fact that sex is illicit and illegal, and it adds to the thrill that they get. And the John School results, I think, have to do with impacting the amenable to change population. There's a certain set of guys who aren't meaning harm. I don't want to make them sound better than they are, but they don't understand the harm it's causing. And when you see them in the class, when you talk to them afterwards, when you see the survey results, I would say a third to a half of them seem very shaken up and really surprised about how harmful prostitution generally is for the provider.
Michael Shively, Senior Associate at the Center on Crime, Drugs, and Justice at Apt Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who researched the effectiveness of John School programs. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we'll speak with one of those former providers, a former prostitute who now lectures at a John School in Massachusetts. Also later today, why is the Christmas Day bomb suspect being tried in a civilian rather than a military court? That's later. Back in 1 minute, here now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about John Schools, programs that educate men about the consequences of prostitution as a way to reduce the demand for paid sex and the problems it causes. In Worcester, Massachusetts, men arrested for soliciting prostitutes can opt to take a class where they hear from medical professionals about health risks, a city counselor about how prostitution affects her constituents, and then they hear from Tina. Tina is not her real name. For years, she used it while working the streets of Boston's red light district. Back then, she says she told men what they wanted to hear. Now she tells them the truth and a warning that what she tells them may not be suitable for all ears. Tina, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Thank you.
Also with us is Kathy Beauvert. She runs the Community Approach to Reduce Demand program, that's the name of it, for the Worcester YWCA. In fact, it was her idea, and she lobbied to get it started. Kathy, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be here.
And Tina, we want to start with you. If you would do me a favor, if you can, place yourself in this classroom we're talking about. And I know it becomes a very emotional situation. We want to talk more about that. But if you could just for a minute place yourself back there, what kinds of things do you tell these men?
I tell them that you when I was having sex with you, I didn't like it. I didn't like when you touched me. I didn't like it. And that's on the contrary to what I told them when I was in the street. I was told them, you know, hey, baby, for a good time and for a little bit more, I'll do this and I'll like doing this. And that's contrary to what I told them when I was in the street.
So given that you tell these men that I didn't like it, in fact, sometimes you got hurt. Do you tell them about that?
Right. I tell them about the attempted rapes, the not making my quota for the night was usually I get in, the pimp would physically abuse me if I didn't make my quota, if I came home without making enough money. There was nights that I was attempted raped with a John and wanting to go home, and the pimp would still say, you know, take a 20-minute break and get back out there.
You were stabbed?
I was stabbed. I was stabbed 5 times. 3 times in the back, 2 times in the chest. My lung was punctured in an attempt to leave.
You know, Kathy, Tina's story is powerful, but it's not unfamiliar. I mean, we've heard this so many times. You know, how does it hit the men? And is it possible they haven't heard this? They don't know this?
Well, I don't know whether they've heard it or not, but what I do know is that it's easy to objectify and depersonalize individuals if you don't have contact with them. You know, attitudes and beliefs that say that, you know, I can pay and do whatever anything I want to you. You're nothing. You're nobody because, you know, you've objectified that person.
So they delude themselves until they are maybe confronted with someone like Tina.
Well, I think that's probably true. I think, again, there's a lot of myths in relation to systems of prostitution. And one of the big ones is that it's a choice and that women are willingly participating. You know, they're getting paid. You know, it's an even exchange. That's it.
Kathy, you have worked with the women as well as the men, and you say you've seen parallels, you know, not with everyone, but parallels between some men who beat women and are involved in domestic violence and men who buy women, that they both somehow feel that it's their right.
Yeah, sure. Well, if you look at attitudes and beliefs of systems of prostitution or systems of domestic violence, you know, one of the traits which is common is certainly an attitude and belief of, the man rules the roost, women are objects. So, you know, in a case of domestic violence where, you know, whether there's verbal abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, you know, a partner has a posture that, you know, I can do whatever I want to you because you're my possession. So if you translate that into systems of prostitution, a man would very well feel entitled by purchasing, you know, exchanging money or exchanging drugs and money or exchanging lodging or whatever the transaction is, that I can do what I want to you because I own you.
Yeah. Well, and Tina, what do you see in the men's faces when you're talking?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that because I see a lot of different things, and some I feel like we really aren't even making a difference, but a few at every class that I see that I am really touching with my story. I've seen tears in men's eyes as I talk. In every class, there's at least 2 or 3 men that I feel like I am really touching with my story.
Kathy, what do you say to people who say, oh, but we live in a different world? You can have call girls and you can work directly with young girls who don't have pimps. Or you can go to the internet, and it's not the same abuse of women as young kids like Tina was on street corners.
Well, I think that that's a common question and a perception that is not correct. No matter how you dress it up, mm-hmm. It's still violence against women. Women that I have spoke with who are in the internet genre still have been assaulted.
Well, I'm thinking of the Craigslist masseuse who was murdered in a hotel room here in the Massachusetts area.
Well, exactly my point. You know, so again, there's a lot of arguments, and I think where it depends where you are in that particular issue. But I think the other thing that's important to say about that is, you know, just like with pornography, you know, and systems of pornography, which is part of the sex industry, you know, not only does it make children more vulnerable to being exploited, and oftentimes that's who's being used in these high-end, you know, get runaways, get individuals who come from broken homes or have been abused. But the bottom line is, anytime whoever's holding the money has the power.
That's Kathy Beauvais. She runs the Community Approach to Reduce Demand Program, or DAWN, for the Worcester, Massachusetts YWCA. We've also been speaking with Tina, a former prostitute and now lecturer in the John classes at that program. Tina, Kathy, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, taking a look ahead. Tomorrow in Here and Now, Libya, the home of the Lockerbie bomber, is now crowing. It's found a way to foil Al-Qaeda. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, what would Ambrose Bierce say? That's after the latest news here and now. The Consumer Electronics Show opens in Las Vegas on Wednesday, but this year the real high-tech thunder might be stolen by Google, which plans to upstage the Las Vegas show with an event of its own tomorrow, when it's expected the company will unveil the much-awaited Google phone. Remember, the same kind of upstaging happened 3 years ago when the iPhone was unveiled just before the Consumer Electronics Show, so this year, will the Google phone also trump the iPhone? John Abel is New York City Bureau Chief for Wired.com. John, some tech geeks are saying this is going to change everything. What do you think?
Well, I suppose it could change everything, although the iPhone's been out for 3 years. It changed everything, I think, to the extent that no one quite anticipated. So it came from, the iPhone came from being a giant killer to the giant, and I think most of us think that we'll see it when we believe it, that something can come along and knock it off its perch.
Well, for those of us who are still trying to, you know, get phone numbers into our standard cell phones, just remind us, the iPhone has touchscreen, has a lot of applications, you can do different things with it. Then we had the Droid phone from Verizon, and now the Google. What's the difference?
Very little is different. They all make it pretty easy to sync up with information that you have on your home computer. They both have a range of external applications which make it possible to do things that you can imagine and things that you can't imagine, although right now Apple has about five times as many as Google does. The difference between the Droid phone and the iPhone is the operating system, which is where Google comes in. So Google has come up with a brand new way of running a mobile phone. And this Nexus One phone, this alleged Nexus One phone that they will allegedly launch tomorrow, is the first one that they have a personal hand in manufacturing.
And what do you mean by, you know, the operating system? What, just tell us a little bit more.
Sure. Well, I mean, your computer is made up of two things. It's made up of hardware and software. And the operating system is the basic software which makes it turn on and run the other programs. So there are a few operating systems for mobile phones, Windows Mobile, Symbian is used around the world, Apple's operating system for the iPhone, and Android is the operating system that Google has developed.
But we thought that the Droid phone from Verizon, you know, uses the Android operating system, which Google owns and which Google is apparently going to use in its new phone. So why is Google bothering to do a new phone?
Well, you might just as well ask why are there so many different kinds of cell phones or different kinds of smartphones.
Right.
They all do slightly different things. They attempt to be better than the one that was out last year. Since we don't even exactly officially know that there will be one, it's hard to speculate. Although we do suspect that it'll have some of the very cool features that the iPhone had, as you mentioned, multi-touch. The accelerometer, which the phone knows exactly the position it's being held in, and geolocation and things like that. And this is an attempt by Google to have an influence on the hardware as opposed to just the software.
Right. Well, and as you said, we don't even really know if this is really happening tomorrow, but this phone that we don't really know is really being announced tomorrow is supposedly going to be sold only online. It'll have a 2-year contract with T-Mobile?
Yes. It'll be available in a so-called unlocked state, which means that you can buy it without a contract, and you find a contract that you like someplace, and will also be apparently available through T-Mobile, which will heavily subsidize the purchase price. That's the way these things work with phones. But then you'll pay them whatever they ask for, probably a two-year contract.
Well, I guess we'll be hearing tomorrow more about what it looks like and feels like, and that'll have a lot to do with it as well. John Abel, New York City Bureau Chief for Wired.com. It's sort of let the wars begin or continue, I guess.
That's it. It's round six now, I think.
Yeah. John, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or anything. You can email us from your smartphones or go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us, or just scroll down and leave a comment right there. And remember, you can also follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. Back in 30 seconds, the Christmas bomb suspect has once again raised the debate, which is the best way to get intelligence? That's in 30 seconds, Here and Now. The Obama administration is defending its decision to bring terror suspect Umar Farouk Abdul-Muttalib to trial in federal court rather than interrogate him as a military prisoner. Republican Senator Jim DeMint is one of many administration critics who say that if the suspected Christmas Day bomber had been treated as a terrorist, he would have immediately been interrogated military style instead of being given the rights of an American and lawyers. Yesterday, President Obama's chief counterterrorism adviser, John Brennan, admitted on Fox News that Abdul-Muttalib was initially talking to people who detained him after his plane landed in Detroit, but now has a public defender and doesn't have to talk. But Brennan said that in the past, terrorism suspects have given the U.S. government valuable information as part of the civilian plea bargain process, and that a federal trial for Abdul-Muttalib is the best way to pursue a war on terror.
This president is determined, and I think it is demonstrated in his language. He says that we're at war with al-Qaeda. We're going to destroy al-Qaeda, the organization, and we're going to demonstrate through our actions, whether it be in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and other places, that al-Qaeda might be able to run, but they're not going to be able to hide.
Bobby Chesney is a national security law specialist with the University of Texas. He also recently served on the Justice Department's new Detainee Policy Task Force, and he joins us from Austin. Professor Chesney, first of all, what choices were there for the Justice Department in deciding whether to grant Muttalib a trial?
Well, Robin, thanks for having me on. In theory, you have at least three choices as to how to deal with this fellow once he's on the ground. You could proceed as he was proceeded against, arrest him and put him into the criminal justice process on the civilian side. In theory, you could try to hold him as a military detainee in the same capacity that we hold still about 200 people at Guantanamo. In theory, you could also go further on the military side and prosecute him militarily, right? Hold him as a military detainee and then slot him for a trial before a military commission. The reason you could, in theory, do the latter two things is that the claim appears to be that this individual was part of al-Qaeda, in particular part of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which would bring him within the scope of the president's military detention power that President Obama has asserted and defended in the courts, and that the district courts in the Guantanamo habeas cases have, by and large, endorsed him as actually having. And as for the commissions, in order to be eligible for the commissions, according to the newly enacted legislation that reformed or revised the commission process, you have to be what's called an alien, unprivileged, enemy belligerent, which is a pretty complex term. It's quite a mouthful. What it means in literal terms is you have to be either someone who engaged in hostilities against the United States or its partners, someone who materially supported such hostilities, or just simply a part of al-Qaeda at the time the alleged offense occurred. And so that's what could have been done. That doesn't mean that that's what should have been done.
Well, tell us more about the debate. We heard John Brennan saying that people who are in civilian trials, the lawyers are well aware of plea bargain prospects, and they've gotten valuable intelligence through that. He cites Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, as an example. So what is the debate?
The question here is not so much, you know, were there other options for how to proceed against the guy, but whether it was smart to go after him, especially in terms of what the impact of the choice is on intelligence gathering or information gathering. And I don't think anyone disagrees that it's terribly important to try to learn what this guy can tell us about who he may have been working with, who dispatched him, who provided him with these technologies he was using to try to create the weapon and so forth. One criticism has been that by putting him in a criminal justice system, he's not going to talk to anyone, and we miss out on the chance to use interrogation techniques that the military can use consistent with the Army Field Manual on interrogation. On the other hand, it appears that this person was already talking quite a bit from the moment of capture, revealing information, and it's not at all determined that he won't continue to talk. And as you say, the prospect of a relatively surefire lengthy sentence is something that can be used to leverage information out of the person and has been done successfully in the past. That doesn't mean it will or won't work in this one particular instance, but it certainly can be done. We don't know that it would be any more productive to proceed with the sorts of interrogation techniques that can lawfully be pursued with respect to someone in military custody.
So Abdul Muttalib is currently being held in Milan, Michigan. What's next for him?
So he's already been arrested on the basis of a criminal complaint that charges him with attempting to destroy the aircraft and bringing a destructive device on the aircraft. Chances are at some point there will be a formal indictment that will certainly contain those charges, may contain other charges, adding such things as material support for Al-Qaeda, that sort of charge. In the end, he'll face a constellation of charges that will ensure in all foreseeable circumstances, a hefty sentence, presumably a life sentence of some sort. And this is going to be weighing down on him. And the really interesting thing to watch for will be if, in the face of this, that becomes sufficient leverage to get him to become a cooperating witness of some kind. I don't know that this guy is in a position to provide really useful intelligence, but I have to assume he probably is. And there's a substantial chance that we'll see something along those lines. It's certainly happened before. Now, the critics say that that may or may not happen. We should have him in military custody so he can be more aggressively interrogated. That might produce more information, but again, we have no guarantee that it would. It might not.
Well, do you get, though, into real political hot water if there is a plea bargain? On the one hand, the government may get information. On the other, critics would say, why is he being given less of a sentence?
Right. This is a guy who tried to kill all these people. He should never walk the streets again. I would tend to agree with that personally when I think about it. It's a real dilemma, frankly, for the decision makers as to whether to accept a plea deal, right, and under what circumstances. Would it be adequate to give this guy a 25-year sentence rather than life in exchange for getting substantial aid in identifying and preventing other plots? On one hand, there's a strong desire for retribution, and on the other hand, there's a desire to make sure you get the information you need to head off other future plots.
That's Bobby Chesney, a national security law specialist with the University of Texas, who also served in the Justice Department's newly formed Detainee Policy Task Force, talking to us about the Obama administration decision to try the alleged Christmas Day bomb suspect in a civilian court as opposed to interrogating him as a military prisoner. Professor Chesney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this note, Dubai opened the world's tallest skyscraper today. The building is 2,717 feet tall, 50 stories higher than Chicago's Willis Tower, formerly the Sears Tower. Today it was named Burj Khalifa in honor of the ruler of Abu Dhabi, which has pumped billions of dollars into cash-strapped Dubai. Bill Baker, a structural engineer on the tower, told Sky News that the building is so high, the weather actually changes the higher up you go.
You actually get a climate change as you go higher in the building. I've been in the middle of the summer. I've gone from the bottom of the building to the top, and at the bottom, and it's been quite hot and humid. At the top, it's just warm and pleasant.
The building was designed to withstand terrorist strikes with a reinforced concrete structure and refuge floors at 25 to 30 story intervals. We'll be back in just a minute with some language pet peeves. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. What's that which versus that rule again? How about lie versus lay? Or the bane of my existence, fewer and less? Yes, I often hear from you and I get them wrong. Thank you for listening critically. And thank goodness Ambrose Bierce isn't alive and listening as well. Ambrose Bierce was a journalist, satirist, Civil War memoirist, but he was also a usage cop, and he vents about his pet peeves in his 1909 book, Write It Right, A Little Blacklist of Literary Faults. Well, modern-day wordsmith Jan Freeman decided it was time to take another look at Write It Right and also ask, What from Bierce's Little Blacklist survives today? Jan's new book is titled Ambrose Bierce's Write It Right, The Celebrated Cynic's Language Peeves, Deciphered, Appraised, and Annotated for 21st Century Readers. She also writes a column on language for the Boston Globe. So, Jan, let's start. Bierce did not like pay a visit or spend time. Why? What was so wrong with those phrases?
All of the Americans who were trying to improve their speech around these decades after the Civil War were anxious about sounding too slangy and anxious about sounding too American and very anxious about sounding too commercial. This was an inherited prejudice from all the centuries of English snobbery about people making their livings through commerce and trade. And Bierce was hypersensitive. That may be because he was actually born poor, self-educated, never finished high school, and therefore was probably even more snobbish than some of the snobs to the manor born. He was so sensitive to anything sounding like commercial language that he thought pay a visit and spend time got too close to using commercial language. He had another problem with spend time, one that reflects his very literal cast of mind. He said, you can't spend time because time goes whether you tell it to go or not. Yeah. It's not like money, which you have some say in the matter. It goes from us whether we like it or not.
Over time, things that he found so appalling, we've adopted. We spend time all the time. We don't worry about it. But some of the things that he wrote about, I hear from listeners all the time, there's still that same feeling. It's like having a fingernail across a board when you hear less and fewer confused and lie and lay confused. He was adamant about those.
People are still adamant about those, and I don't know that there's any easy way to predict which of these peeves are going to last for a century and which are simply going to evaporate from our collective consciousness. Lie and lay is probably more of a trigger point for people because it's not just a changing meaning of a word. It's actually grammar, although those words have always been confused and confusable because they're so similar, because they're different versions of the same verb.
But remind us the easy way to remember the correct usage?
You lay a pen down, but you lie down yourself.
Right.
But because lay and laid, the past tense, are so similar, you can't even hear the difference. I lay down yesterday. I laid down yesterday. And that's one of the major reasons that they aren't clear in people's minds, and
right.
I seriously doubt that they ever will be.
Fewer and less we can clearly distinguish.
You know, we can, but Bierce was at sort of the beginning of the campaign to make those clearly divided. A lot of people think that there's no overlap. That's not actually true.
Oh, no.
The basic rule is that you want fewer for countable things and less for masses, quantities of things. But it's really okay to say 10 items or less.
Oh, no, it's not. You should hear what happens
I
say that.
I know. One of my very first columns was on this topic, and people were enraged at the supermarkets, and some of those signs got changed. But when I was reading comic books, there used to be essay contests that said 250 words or less. And what that means is, here's the upper limit. It doesn't mean we're going to count the words one by one. It means take it as a quantity. You can have 10 items or less, up to 10 items. And that has always been normal English. Again, there was a great project among these usage writers to neaten the language wherever they could, to separate words, you know, like not having their food touch on the plate, and they didn't want meanings to touch each other in the same word. But a lot of those attempts were just doomed from the start.
Well, and there's one word he hated in, you know, 1909, turn of that century, that we use all the time today, gubernatorial. It's an ugly word, but why did he not like it?
He really didn't have any larger reason for disliking it than we do. It's clunky. It's not perfectly derived from its Latin roots, apparently.
Well, here's what he writes. Eschew it. It is not English. It is needless and bombastic. Leave it to those who call a political office a chair. Gubernatorial chair is good enough for them. So is hanging.
Yes, Bierce is an early exemplar of what we now call word rage, that if you use such a word, you ought to be, you know, hanged or thrown in jail or beaten up. I mean, you'll find a lot of that in the comments sections when people write about usage. You know, hanging's too good for them. Boil them in oil.
And there's another word that some of us in our lifetime have seen the usage change, and that's graduate. And he writes about that. Graduate has gone from was graduated to graduated from.
Right. When Bierce was writing, it was still I was graduated from college. It was just beginning to change so that you were allowed to say, I graduated from college. This was considered pretty adventurous and new and perhaps disrespectful to the college, but that was the usage. And over the 20th century, we pretty much all thought graduate from college was perfectly fine. Then in the 80s, people started saying, I graduated college.
Yep.
Without the from. That finally killed off the earlier controversy, because with this new interloper, nobody was going to waste any time trying to go back to, I was graduated from college. They all had to man the barricades against, I graduated college. But it looks like that's coming along too.
Well, Jan Freeman, what does this say to you? Because you labor over a word column and discussing the correct way to use a word. Are we just sort of spinning our wheels here, wasting our time, if it's going to change anyway?
In effect, yes and no. When I was an editor, after all, I was a copy editor for years, and my job then was to enforce the style that we wanted at whatever publication I worked for. There were certain words we didn't use. We tried to get our lays and lies correct. We wanted to all achieve that standard. But as I began to research the history of word usage, it became clear that there were much more interesting stories in there than the ongoing battle between, you know, less and fewer. And the way these things evolve over time, back and forth, and often just according to fashion, nothing more than that. Yes, I do believe more and more that although there is a dialect called Standard English that many people are going to want to learn and use, it's not really helpful to go around shaking your finger at people and saying, no, 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 you used less and fewer wrong, you used lie and lay wrong, because there is a level at which whatever the people say is what's going to happen.
I'm with you. Listeners, when I do the lie and lay, fewer, less, but you know what? It feels good when you think and get it right. I mean, it does feel better, so.
Well, you know what? It feels good when you get it right according to those rules you learned. But it also feels good to be able to say to someone, no, it's not true. You can say, the girl that I marry, there's nothing wrong with using that about a person. That has never really been a rule. There's nothing wrong with splitting an infinitive. There never has been in English. So,
split one for us.
To boldly go, the classic split infinitive. They're not all that common, but they certainly have never been as taboo as people would like you to think they are. I've just learned that, you know, you can still be a sort of snooty, superior copy editor type of person, but you take it to a new level by knowing which things you thought were wrong maybe really aren't that wrong.
That's Jan Freeman. Her language column for the Boston Globe is called The Word, and her new book is Ambrose Bierce's Write It Right, W-R-I-T-E, It R-I-G-H-T, The Celebrated Cynic's Language Peeves, Deciphered, Appraised, and Annotated for 21st Century Readers. Jen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.